me something, and that, you know, and that we all got that opportunity, mm-hmm. and we all hurt each other.
Well, it's really nerve-wracking, like, in the beginning, telling these stories, because you want to get all the details right. You take a sort of sense of ownership of somebody else's story, and that you are responsible for conveying the right moments at the right time and conveying certain emotions over others. And you just want to, like, you want to do right by somebody else, mm-hmm. you know, in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you guys one quick question? So this idea that, like, sometimes when we hear each other, we feel more connected, like, this word empathy, you know, gets brought out a lot right now. Like you were saying, like, we're disconnected. So everyone's like, how can we be more connected? How can we understand things about each other, even though we think we're so different that we might have in common? Do you guys think this does this? Like, do you think telling stories about our lives helps be more empathetic? Like, how come? Like, I'm just curious. Like,
to answer your question, I think, like, the biggest part about it is you tell someone something really intimate and personal about yourself, mm-hmm. and you have to kind of trust them. And a lot of us, I mean, whether intrinsic or external or whatever you want to call it, type of people, when you trust people with, like, that kind of information just a little bit, it makes your relationship grow a little bit more, mm-hmm. and it becomes more of a friendship instead of just acquaintances and people you know. It turns into kind of like that friendship and bond that you have, and you have to open up about personal stuff if that's what you're going to do. And from there on, it just starts to kick off. Just like earlier today, I kind of knew Dallas. We knew a little bit about each other, but now she knows a lot about my life story. I know a lot of the struggles and stuff she went through and what she likes to do now. And I know her a lot better as a person. But I would have never known that if I didn't share probably my story, if we didn't have another conversation. Mm-hmm. So this type of process really helps us to get to know each other a lot better, for sure.
You've been listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm Carlos Chavez, and on this edition of Political Perspectives, we joined Portland State University's Inside Out Capstone course, held this fall at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility. The class, which was facilitated by instructor Deborah Arthur and myself, focused on what home means to us and on incorporating the Narrative 4 process of radical empathy through story sharing. This has been my third time co-facilitating this class with Deborah at McLaren, and as always, this experience has been a great one. This time around, we had an amazing group of students, and the content was extremely insightful. I always look forward to working with my friend Deb and our students, and I want to close out by thanking her and our class, as well as Hope Partnership and the Oregon Youth Authority for letting us do this. Thanks for tuning in. Check out more great programming on KBOO 90.7 FM, and feel free to check out past material or stream live programs at kboo.fm.
This is Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. Thank you to all of you for contributing in the pledge drive. We collected tens of thousands of dollars, and that's a grand thing. And if you weren't quite able to get in on the fund, well, you can still pull up kboo.fm and click on that and give us a taste, because that's how we roll. That's how we operate. Earlier this week, NBC News ran a piece on their nightly news encouraging Americans to think of nuclear war as survivable. And they decided they'd make a preemptive strike against any left opinion by putting on some smirking bastard trying to smear anti-war activists in advance by implying that they all believe California will fall into the sea. But the premise that they promoted is that the DPRK, North Korea, could use a 10-kiloton bomb against L.A. And there's some problems with that. For one thing, North Korea has already tested 165 kilotons, and I imagine if they were ever to engage in such a desperate ploy, they would not go light. The broadcast also took the assumption that nuclear war with North Korea would not spread to a nuke war with Russia and China, guaranteeing 20 or 40 250 kiloton, 500 kiloton, 1 megaton bombs on LA and every other major city, which would not be survivable in any sense. Then they give the advice. The funny thing was, the advice they gave wasn't even good for, I mean, obviously they meant areas that were not directly struck by the bomb, and they were trying to give you ideas for fallout. They said, go to the middle of your apartment office, or go to the middle of your house, as if that could work versus spreading deadly fallout. Meanwhile, alarmingly, the Chinese are also issuing warnings and preparations and instructions versus nuclear war, although they are taking the far more practical step of distributing iodine tablets to displace the radioactive iodine that would disperse after a nuclear detonation. By the way, if you want to prepare for the possibility that some nukes will go off, you really can't prepare. There's nothing to do but die and only hope that you die swiftly in the case of a major nuclear exchange. But if the DPRK managed to set off a nuke, or if the U.S. sets off nukes over the DPRK, we could have some poisonous radioactive material spreading over this way. Or, you know, if God forbid they set off one on our beloved land here, you will need those iodine pills. They work by displacing the radioactive iodine. And you're not going to be able to get them after the fact. So think about that. Maybe time for iodine pills, I'm very sorry to say. The Chinese article, pardon me, was accompanied. It was a newspaper article in Jilin, China, near the border with North Korea. It was accompanied by cartoon illustrations asking people to close their windows and doors during an emergency and immediately take a shower and wash out their mouths and ears after being exposed to radiation. The newspaper has previously run reports on how to ward off the impact of radioactive contamination following the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan in March 2011, but has not specifically discussed nuclear weapons before. By the way, Fukushima is worse. It keeps getting worse. It hasn't been in the press, but it's getting worse. Changing topics, U.S. President Donald Trump announced on Wednesday that the U.S. will recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and initiate a process of moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. This is from Radio Havana, Cuba. Political observers say the move will upend decades of international peace efforts. The announcement has already sparked a massive international backlash with leaders of Britain, France, Iran, Jordan, Egypt, Turkey, the Arab League, and other nations all criticizing the move. And there's talk of an intifada. Skipping ahead to another Radio Havana Cuba article. In the U.S., the Pentagon official has said that military forces are poised to stay in Syria for, quote, as long as we need to, end quote. Pentagon spokesman Eric Payan told reporters in Washington that the U.S. troop commitment on the ground will support our partners and prevent the return of terrorist groups. The Department of Defense spokesman on Iraq and Syria also repeated Washington's stance that the U.S. and its allies are fighting the Daesh Takfiri group there. Pound further announced that there would be no timeline to determine if and when they may leave, as their presence is conditions-based. Quoting the spokesman, to ensure an enduring defeat of ISIS, the coalition must ensure it cannot regenerate, reclaim lost ground, or plot external attacks. This is essential to the protection of our homeland, as well as to defend our allies and partners. The United States will sustain a conditions-based military presence in Syria to combat the threat of terrorist-led insurgency, prevent the resurgence of ISIS, and stabilize liberated areas. Now, if you don't recall the congressional vote on invading and occupying Syria indefinitely, that's because there hasn't been one. Again, from Radio Havana, Cuba, which is just red hot this week. People of all ages and walks of life marched in Chicago's financial district, where clusters of banks, trusts, and other upper-class Americans work. The protesters carried signs and chanted for equality. And for Republican senators to be held accountable for approving the sweeping tax overhaul, they said the tax bill will make significant cuts to government-sponsored medical insurance and provides large tax breaks for some of the wealthiest people in the country. Similar demonstrations were held in several major cities, including Los Angeles, California, Boston. The U.S. Senate over the weekend approved the sweeping tax legislation, voting 51 to 49 in favor of the nation's largest tax overhaul. The Senate version of the bill, and one passed earlier this month by the House of Representatives, must now be reconciled into a single bill and approved again by both houses of Congress. The single bill would then go to the White House, where Trump is expected to sign it. Before the end of the year, under the bill, the corporate tax rate would be permanently slashed to 20% from 35%. And speaking for myself, of course, corporations don't even pay that. And another thing that it does is eliminate the minimum taxes. So corporations will be happy to do as well. Nike Corporation, for example, Exxon, and other major corporations have done in the past, which is to pay no taxes at all. Thank you very much. Here's our official dodge written out on a book-length stack of paper. Returning to the Radio Havana article, the broad-based U.S. tax cuts, proposed by the Trump administration would mostly benefit the very wealthy while adding $2.4 trillion to the budget deficit over 10 years, according to an analysis by the Tax Policy Center. And again, speaking for myself, of course, under the new schedule, the working class, that's you, anyone who receives a paycheck, and my definition here is working class, shake off that idea of it being blue collar, you're working class if you're getting a check and depend on it. We'll all pay that $2.4 trillion, and I'll have more to say about what $1 trillion is. Because there are several reasons why the population of the United States doesn't rise up in fury against the parasites who are destroying our future and our present. And one of those is just not really fully understanding what's going on. So you're listening to Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. My tiny little effort to put a crack in that ignorance and, frankly, to raise up that fury because it's appropriate. Now, from LiveScience.com, the bailout of AIG after the mortgage-backed securities crisis cost the U.S. more than $125 billion. So there's a number, B with a billion, billion with a B. We're going to dig into this. The Panama Papers document had upward of $20 trillion hidden in a dark labyrinth of shell companies and other tax shelters over the past 40 years. Pause to cough. The recently published Paradise Papers paint an even more extensive picture, and you can find that on theguardian.co.uk. It's not well covered in the United States. The Paradise Papers, something you need to remember. You've heard of the Panama Papers. Remember the Paradise Papers. But they write at LiveScience.com, on the bright side, we recovered $165 million in bonuses from AIG executives. That's something, right? Let's find out. Let's do a thought experiment on a scale where $1 million is reduced to one penny. One penny. The AIG bailout cost, if you stack those pennies, $1,250. The Panama Papers document, stack the pennies, is $200,000. In pennies, right? Remember, because $1 million is a penny. On the bright side, we recovered $1.65, get it, in the pennies, in executive bonuses. So let me read that again. We're going to reduce, for the thought experiment, $1 million to a penny. The AIG bailout, free money, for the mortgage industry, cost taxpayers $1,250, the Panama Papers, $200,000. On the bright side, we recovered $1.65. That's what happens when the American population gets a buzz going between their ears when they hear millions, billions, and trillions. So let's go a little further with this. And by the way, you can find this article at livescience.com. I would suggest using a search engine. It won't give you the whole URL, which is quite long. Go to a search engine, DuckDuckGo, for example, and put in billions and trillions live science. run the word live science, words live science together, and you can find it that way. So let's run through that again. If one penny represents a million, then 1,000 pennies or $10 represents a billion on the same scale. 1 million pennies or 10,000 represents a trillion. When assessing a $1 trillion expenditure, debating $1 billion is quibbling over 10 bucks on a $10,000 purchase. Got it? You wouldn't quibble over $10 on a $10,000 purchase. So $1 billion and a $1 trillion expenditure is diddly. If you'll pardon me for using the technical language, it is diddly squat. And I just said that the wealth transfer from the poor and the working class in the United States, who, as we all know, are doing so well that they're intentionally vacationing on sidewalks just to see what it's like, that comes to $1.4 trillion. So here we've scaled monetary amounts so that 1 million comprises one unit, then equated that unit to a familiar and paltry quantity, one penny. Scaling numbers to the realm of the familiar harnesses our intuition towards understanding relative sizes. And speaking for myself, I would like to think that it harnesses your intuition to realizing that we must organize and strike. In a soundbite, a savings of 200 million might sound comparable to a $20 trillion cost. It's the Ilion that does it, I guess. Scaling reveals the truth. The first is a $2 beverage, the other a $200,000 price of an American home. That's the comparison of 200 million to 20 trillion. Now let's continue this thought experiment and say if time were money. Suppose you landed a job paying $1 per second. That comes out to $3,600 per hour. That'd be pretty darn good pay. For simplicity, let's assume that you're paid this $3,600 per hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You're just continually making this $3,600 per hour, $1 per second. At this rate, it would take 1 million seconds to acquire $1 million. How long is that in familiar terms? In round numbers, a million seconds is 17,000 minutes. That's 280 hours or 11.6 days at $1 per second. Chances are you can retire comfortably at the end of a month or a few. So let's have the same job, $3,600 an hour, 24 hours a day. You want to accumulate $1 billion at this fantastic, amazing, unbelievable, no one gets this salary, right? Actually, some people do. Well, it'll take you 31 years. Doable, but you'd better start young. Now let's talk about $1 trillion under this paradigm, which I'm speaking of here, in which you're getting $3,600 every hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. How long will it take you to accumulate $1 trillion, you know, the amount that Jeff Bezos is approaching right now by sucking the blood of people working their knees and ankles and elbows off as fast as they possibly can until they get burned out and get kicked out? That's getting close to how much Bezos is going to have. It's just going to be a year or so before Bezos has $1 trillion. Now, suppose that you were such an unbelievably productive worker that you could get that $3,600 an hour, 24 hours a day. How long would it take you to get $1 trillion? 31,000 years. 31,000 years. This analogy gives a taste for the absolute size of a billion and perhaps of a trillion. It also shows the utter impossibility of an ordinary worker earning $1 billion. No job pays around-the-clock hourly wage of $3,600. That would be nice work if you can get it. But the point, and speaking for myself, is we have the habit, we all of us have the habit, and we constantly slide back into it, of saying that Jeff Bezos earned $900 billion. Of saying that the Koch brothers earn billions of dollars. They do not earn this. You cannot. It's physically impossible. It's allocated to them by a system of parasitism. This is sucked up from millions of people. If you have 1 million people working for you, and you're a very, very generous person, and under capitalism, you know, generosity means a different thing. So you're very generous and you have 1 million people working for you. Well, what's 1,000 million? That's a billion. So if you have them work and then pay them almost all of their work except for $1,000, if you pay them almost entirely the value of their productivity minus $1,000 each, which doesn't happen, not even close, never, if people can possibly help it, you'd be a billionaire. So I'm trying to make the point that this society is utterly, hideously corrupt, out of control, and it's that kind of power that makes these people sneer and swagger and say that, you know, their every pronouncement is a thousand times, a million times more brilliant than anything you can possibly think of. And of course, President Trump is a perfect example of this. An overwhelming narcissism that completely clouds over any possibility of rational thought. People in this state are in a dangerous and irrational mental state. They should not be rulers. They should not have access to the wealth of kings and emperors. Let's examine the wealth of actual multi-billionaires. Our calculations prove that they acquired more than a dollar per second over long intervals. How much more? Testifying to the Senate Judiciary Committee on July 27th, William Browder, an American-born businessman with extensive Russian dealings, estimated that Vladimir Putin controls assets of $200 billion. This puts him in the range of American billionaires. Let's assume this figure is substantially correct and that Putin's meteoric rise began 17 years ago when he first became president of Russia. What is Putin's average income? 17 years is 540 million seconds. 200 billion divided by this is $370 per second, $1,340,000 per hour. Yet even at this colossal rate, acquiring 1 trillion takes 85 years. The Panama Papers documented some $20 trillion, and that's the T with a trillion. Are we getting an idea of how much that is now? The combined fortunes of 100 Vladimir Putins, many of them American, sequestered in shell companies, untaxed and untraceable. Though the rate of leakage has surely increased over time, for simplicity, let's assume this wealth has bled steadily from the global economy, an annual loss of about $500 billion a year. Pardon me for repeating myself there. How much is it in familiar terms? To find out, divide 500 billion by 31.6 million seconds. Conservatively speaking, the Panama Papers document an ongoing loss to the world, averaging $16,000 per second around the clock for 40 years. Now, hearing this and getting some idea of the scale of corruption and parasitism, I hope that you will never say that we here in the United States have an overwhelming people. Have an overwhelming problem with people who don't have enough to even pay rent because they are, pick your insult. That's not the problem. The problem is that the American society is so corrupt that it does not spend its money where it should be spent first. And it is in our own, that is on our own people, for our own people, for ourselves. And all of the problems that arise from that arise from the parasitism of the hypercapitalism that we now experience. So that information is from Andrew D. Huang, associate professor of mathematics at the College of the Holy Cross. And as I was saying, you can find it at Science Daily. Let's see. No, excuse me. It's at Live Silent. I'll just try that again. LiveScience.com. LiveScience.com. And the article is Millions, Billion, Trillions, Numbers in the News. You can find that. Now, let's talk a little further about how we are all impoverished. I want to read from an article by Paul Craig Roberts in Counterpunch. It's called Offshoring the Economy, Why the U.S. is on the Road to the Third World. He writes, on January 6, 2004, Senator Charles Schumer and I challenged the erroneous idea that jobs offshoring was free trade. In a New York Times op-ed, our article so astounded economists that within a few days, Schumer and I were summoned to a Brookings Institution conference in Washington, D.C. to explain our heresy. In the nationally televised conference, Paul Craig Roberts declared that the consequence of jobs offshoring would be that the U.S. would be a third world country in 20 years. Now, Roberts uses the term third world country several times in this article. I find it offensive. He is referring to an unindustrialized country subject to invasion, parasitism, and extraction of wealth. Please read the book Open Veins of Latin America by Eduardo Galeano, and you'll understand why I don't like to say third world country. It's like kicking people while they're down. So where he says third world country, I will simply say impoverished and unindustrialized. That was 11 years ago, he writes. And the U.S. was on course to descend to third world status before there is on course. To descend to third world status, to descend to impoverished and unindustrialized status before the remaining 9 years of my prediction have expired, he writes. The evidence is everywhere. In September, the U.S. Bureau of the Census released its report on U.S. household income by quintile, dividing up into five parts as a quintile. Every quintile, as well as the top 5%, has experienced a decline in real household income since their peaks. The bottom quintile has had a 17% decline in real income from the 99 peak. The fourth from the bottom, fourth from the top, has had a 10% decrease. The middle, 6%. The second, 2.8%. And even the top quintile, the top 10%, in the U.S. has had a drop of income of 1.7%. The Census Bureau uses official measures of inflation to arrive at real income. These measures are understated. If more accurate measures of inflation are used, such as those available from shadowstats.com, the declines in real household income are larger and have been declining for a longer period. Some measures show real median household income below the levels of the 1960s and early 70s. Note that these declines have occurred during an alleged six-year economic recovery. This is what you've been told. Oh, there's a recovery going on. Isn't that great? Well, you must be failing in some way. You're not. This is not what this is about. In the aggregate, during a period, returning to the text, when the labor force is shrinking due to a sustained decline in the labor force participation rate. On April 3rd, 2015, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics announced that 93 million Americans of working age are not in the workforce, an historical record. Now, I want to stop on that. There's 300 million people in the United States. I don't know exactly how many people are of working age, but 93 million are not in the workforce. 93 million are not in the workforce. When you hear we're having a recovery, this is a lie. When you hear that things are getting better, this is a lie. When you hear that people are making bad choices and thus ending in poverty because they're spending their money on gambling, statistically, it's a lie. This is not what is happening. And as I was mentioning before, as I was demonstrating with the discussion of what is a million, a billion, and a trillion, I was talking about what we, not we, but what the parasite class does with that money. Hopefully you can see just exactly how we are being crushed under a system of extracting everything, all of our productivity, and taking it away, denying it to us on permanent basis, impoverishing us, stripping away medical care, making us beg for everything. 93 million Americans of working age are not in the workforce. That's more like 50% unemployment. And you can jigger the statistics in various ways. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has been jiggering the statistics since the Reagan administration, adding in the Army, for example. And this has gone on and on and on. As things have gotten worse, the cloud has gotten thicker and thicker, the veil has gotten thicker, and you're not supposed to understand or believe, but please look it up for yourself. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, not hard to find online, 93 million Americans of working age are not in the workforce. A disaster. The worst Great Depression that has ever existed in the United States. That is why people are sleeping on the streets. That and the mind control that makes us think that we're all responsible for pulling ourselves up, levitating by our imaginary bootstraps. Who can afford boots anymore? In 2014, 38% of all American workers made less than $20,000, 51% made less than $30,000, 63% made less than $40,000, and 72% made less than $50,000. 72% made less than $50,000. If you're not making $70,000, you are not paying all of your bills. You're letting things slide. You're skipping things. You're not living a middle-class life. 72% made less than $50,000. The real statistics, the real news that you're not supposed to know. Well, you've been listening to Press Watch. And coming up, Per Fogering will take on many of these topics and continue until 10 o'clock at the top of the hour. The name of his show is Fight the Empire. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, we will hear of flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein at 11 o'clock. Between the Covers, Portland author Rick Leonetti talks about his book, The Man from the Place of Clay. And 11:30, Black Book Talk talks to 17-year-old author Julie Brownell about her book, Me Too, Just a Collection of Reasons You Are So Freakin'. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Why? Because you understand how valuable this sort of broadcasting is. This is for you. And the music, so good, so necessary, makes your life so much better. Tune into the music. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, going out to you via the great red and white Eiffel Tower on the West Hills and other frequencies and other towers elsewhere in Cascadia, 90.7 here in Portland. And you're listening to us on KBOO.fm, and in that manner, we can go out to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In on Saturday, December 9th at 6 p.m. at the Global Homestead Garage in Portland. The community rights movements help cities and towns to protect the health, safety, and welfare of their people and natural areas. At the Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In event, the leaders of Community Rights US will speak, as well as Mark Lakem. Again, that's Creating the Communities We All Yearn to Live In on Saturday, December 9th at 6 p.m. at the Global Homestead Garage, 416 Southeast Oak Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.